Big Cabbage Radio 89.5, and this is Radio Book Club. We'll be discussing Carried in Our Hearts by Jane Aronson. November is Adoption Awareness Month, and I'll be talking about that topic with Betsy Wooden from Alaska Center for Resource Families and Tammy Watson from Catholic Social Services Special Needs Adoption Office. So as preparation for today's show, I mentioned that we read the book Carried in Our Hearts, but I also read another book called The Child Catchers by Catherine Joyce. And it's a little bit different picture of international adoption than when Dr. Aronson paints. And as we talk about the subject, I think it's important to think about the darker side of how children end up coming to this country, as well as those joyful stories that Aronson shares. So before we get started, I want to remind our listeners that you may call in during the live broadcast at noon on November 26th and share your thoughts with us. The number is 745-8900. And, of course, if you have any questions about the topic, too, I'd invite you to call in and ask Betsy and Tammy. So let's start out with what motivates people to adopt from another country as well as within the United States. One thing Joyce talks about is the evangelical Christian movement that spawned a demand for orphans as a way to swell the ranks of their churches. So, you know, I don't, you want to comment on what you see kind of in our own country or in our state as far as people who engage in adoption as part of that, or even as a church community who promote adoption.
Well, I'd like to weigh in. This is Betsy. Prior to the Indian Child Welfare Act, there was that same sort of a thought behind the movement to take a lot of American Indian and Alaska Native children into non-Native homes. And back then, a lot of the compelling reasons, people believed they were doing better for those children, that they weren't getting everything they needed according to sort of the standards of the dominant society, the white society. And so there were huge portions of land that were actually divided up between different faiths, and they were actually able to go in there and set up, you know, programs for those kids that resulted in, you know, children coming into orphanages that weren't necessarily orphans and being placed with in non-Native homes and losing their culture. So it has been a big issue in Alaska, Pacific Northwest, and Canada.
Do you want to comment, Tammy, or?
I can. I mean, I feel like religion is a big motivation for a lot of adoptive families. I mean, I feel like a lot of families that come to us have that that feeling that they're meant to do that, and this is their calling, and God is asking them to. I mean, that's all I really have.
Well, and not to say that that's completely, you know, negative.
No,
and I think that's something that you look at, you know, where when we're talking about motivation for people to adopt, is it kind of this, you know, what Joyce calls, you know, it's almost like a movement within some of these churches which have created incredible need to come up with the children then to fulfill this adoption search that some of these churches engage in. And so that's what her argument is, that then that's what's compelled some of these countries to engage in pulling children, you know, child catchers, she called them. So, you know, it could be kidnapping children or mislabeling children as orphans or giving families in those countries the wrong impressions about what's going to happen to their child, that, you know, they think they're just going over for some education and then they'll be back, and not really appreciating the difference that culture sees. And you know, your point, Betsy, about, you know, within our own state, the idea that when people are adopted into a family or a religion or a different culture, that they may lose complete contact with their own culture, their language, their religion, all of those other pieces of it. So that's, you know, one area, and we'll get into that a little bit more. I think another one that comes up is infertility. So certainly couples that, you know, have tried to have a baby of their own will look at adoption. Do you want to say anything else about that, Tammy? Or is that something you see very often? Or?
For our infant program, I would say that that's a big factor, or that they were able to give birth to one child, and they've been trying, and now they're unable. I feel like that's also a big motivator for somebody. I mean, they want to expand their family, and adoption is a great way to do that. And so I think our infant families, a lot of the time, that's what they're struggling with.
And I guess one of the practical things that you might look at for motivation with that is perhaps they've even conceived and miscarried, or conceived and had a stillbirth, or lost an infant. What might be something that you'd want to consider then if they're now looking to replace, let's say, that lost child?
I think when we talk to our families, we talk to them about their grieving process and what they've done and how they healed. And I think we have a lot of open conversations with them about adoption and if they're ready for that or if they need some more time to grieve or if they need support through that process before they move forward.
And if I could add something here, because I predominantly work with the families that come into the foster care system and many are hoping to adopt. And sometimes they'll be going through your programs and maybe it's, you know, they feel it's taking too long or it's, you know, the cost is prohibitive. And so, and they know of other families that have adopted and it looks pretty easy. So they'll come into foster care orientation to learn about becoming foster parents. And they'll say, you know, we really hope to adopt and we, you know, prefer an infant or a toddler in good health. And that system is not designed, you know, for that purpose. It's not an adoption agency. It's reunification is the first goal. So we might get families sort of move back and forth between multiple programs.
And just with the change in our culture about how unwed mothers are viewed, I mean, the infants that are identified as possibly being an adoption possibility are getting fewer and far between. It's just statistically in our country. So, you know, so what you're talking to people who, you know, are tired of waiting and you know, their hope is that they're going to get that, you know, brand new little baby that's, you know, matches their ethnic background and, you know, it'll be great. So I just read a work of fiction where a family adopts a five-year-old to replace a daughter who died and they give her the same name. So, I mean, that would be a red flag, right? You know, because that's really the sense if we're just replacing the lost one with this one. And that really takes away the identity of this new child, then, I think.
Right, and I think that goes back to make sure that your family's ready to move forward with adoption and their motivation.
Mm-hmm. Like,
and I think with open conversations and, like, a supportive group or staff, that you'd hopefully be able to see that way before a placement happens and they name the child the same name.
Yes. So, like you said, I mean, having those conversations and just being open, yeah. The other group identified was people who had been adopted themselves. Mm-hmm. So that speaks to, I think, that they had a good experience and now they want to share that kind of opportunity with other kids.
Well, and along those lines, too, that adoption was looked at much differently in the past and it was, you know, often very private and secretive and it's changed. And, you know, I think that we tend to look more favorably towards open adoption and birth stories and, you know, sort of accepting the heritage and tradition that children may have had before. And so if you came into it from, you know, I was adopted 50 years ago, the rules have changed quite a bit.
That's a good point. There's not the same stigma attached, you think?
Yeah, I agree with that. Okay. We have actually some adoptive families in our waiting pool that were adopted. And then we have, quarterly, we have infant adoption workshops, and we have panels. And so we have adoptees come in who might have been adopted 40, 50 years ago. And then we have the younger generation that, you know, they're in their mid-20s, late 20s, that they have different stories to tell. I guess their adoptions went differently. So
that's nice. And I don't think culture's completely caught up, though. Because, you know, some of the things Aronson brings up just in adoptive families where if it's obvious that the adopted children are of a different ethnic background, things that people say, well, is that yours? You know,
right.
and where did you get them? And, you know, it's just they, you know, people will say insensitive kinds of things rather than kind of expanding their view that family can be defined in very different ways. So, one person in Aronson's book talked about she was an immigrant, and so she wanted to adopt from that country. So I think it was a Pakistani family, and so they specifically wanted to adopt a child of their own ethnic background. So I don't know if you see much of that, if there's a request or, no, not specifically to, you know, their own ethnic background, or people are more open than that.
I think for the most part they're more open. I mean, sometimes we have families who aren't as open to getting placements of different ethnic backgrounds, but I would say the majority of them really are. I think a lot of our families are open-minded when they come into it.
Well, it probably behooves them because then their options are going to be greater.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some parents may, or some people may want to adopt because they're of their age. And Aronson had many of those stories, women who were past childbearing age. And so this was their opportunity to parent where they had not parented before or even had raised children to adulthood and now wanted to adopt.
And it's my understanding, too, some countries have changed the age at which they'll let you adopt and mm-hmm. are actually have, and you probably know more about that.
Yeah, there's age limits for the different countries, or even the fact if you're single or married, or if you're a single female or a single male, like there's different criteria for different countries. For our infant program, we really don't have an age. Like we don't say 50 or under. It's basically mm-hmm. if you're healthy.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, I see that motivation more in waiting child, more in foster care, less in infant. And at least when they call and talk to us, I think that usually it's they're older, they've had kids grow out of their home, and now they're looking for adoption. But most of the time it is waiting children that are on the exchanges or
So it might older. Be an older child.
Yeah, an yeah. older child, okay. less than the infant. Yeah. That's just our experience.
Okay. And you know, from what we observe in state, we see a lot of family adoptions where it might be grandparents. So we, I think, are more yeah. accustomed to seeing older people that mm-hmm. are reparenting. So, okay. Other people may want to add to their family. We kind of, you mentioned this, that they've had one and now they, you know, this is their way of adding to the family.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things Joyce talks about is those extreme people that it's almost like, she talks about this one woman that she knew that was almost like an addiction. She was pursuing adoption after adoption after an adoption. And so you see some of these expanded families that maybe have 6, 7, 8 of their own children and now have added an equal number of adopted children. So kind of these mega families. Would you have any concerns if you saw that kind of situation, or how would you talk to somebody about that?
Well, and sometimes we do see families, particularly when they're, the children have special needs or challenges, and there could be subsidy, post-adoption subsidies involved, so there's like financial support for their special needs. Sometimes they qualify for disability services, and you'll see families that sort of have adopted a lifestyle that sort of enables them to have a very large family with a lot of high needs, and then they it seems pretty noble on the surface, but there have been occasions where some of these families have not really invested that financial support into the children's needs. And it's been more a way to, like a lifestyle choice.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting way of looking at it, yeah, because they just get very wrapped up in it. And almost then, again, probably the more negative side, but then they can look like, you know, heroes. Look mm-hmm. at what we do, you know, and look at these children that we're raising, and aren't we wonderful people?
Yeah. So. And I think when I get calls and they already have large families and they want to expand or they've adopted before, it goes back to motivation for us, I think. And also through the interviews and the home study process, we get to know more about their abilities, I guess, and what children they would best be able to parent and be able to educate them either, you know, out of it.
Uh-huh.
Like maybe this isn't the best for your family considering uh-huh. the kids that are already placed in your home, or provide more education. Yeah, I think that it for me, it just goes back to the motivation and to talk to them about what it really is about.
And I really think there's a tipping point for some families. I mean, even families that are doing it well, I think we have mm-hmm. to respect that, you know, they may have 10 children in the home. The 11th isn't necessarily, oh, this family's so functional, let's give them another one. That might just be the straw that breaks the camel's back, so to speak.
Right, and that goes back to just making sure that are they really able to add another child into their home that has special needs without, you know, disrupting their current family status.
Right.
Does it raise any red flags if people say that they want to adopt a girl or I want to adopt a boy, that if it's gender specific?
I don't think it raises flags for me. I find, you know, it interesting. But I think even pregnant women, you always go in and people always have I hope it's a girl.
Yeah.
I hope it's a boy.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't necessarily know if it's a red flag. I find it interesting. I'm always like, oh, I wonder what it is about a boy.
Yeah.
And sometimes they are very articulate about why they want a boy or a girl. And sometimes they already have a girl and they'd really want a boy.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if it's a red flag for me.
Okay.
I think there's a piece of that, though, that we do associate with countries like China and Korea, where the status of the girl babies is maybe more questionable than if a boy baby. Mm-hmm. And so we might see, you know, much higher numbers of girl babies available for adoption.
Okay. And just when we were talking about, you know, single status, married status, I think that, you know, unfortunately, and I'll say this unfortunately, that, you know, maybe for single men, if they wanted to adopt a girl, you know, a teen girl, you know, I mean, that would raise red flags for people.
That
even
would
if it was completely innocent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It would be interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
Well, I've seen articles, too, in other parts of the country where race and gender were an issue. So a single black male adopting a white female, you know, child would maybe raise some eyebrows in some communities.
Okay.
And that would, you know, would have to be taken into account if they'd be able to do it safely and successfully.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that it's interesting that you mentioned, like, males. It's weird when a male says, I want a girl. But if a single woman walks in and says, I would really like a 10-year-old boy, there's no red flags.
Right.
So I think it's just
statistics support that we would, be more. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
So, but along that line, probably some controversial families would be same-sex families. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's been quite a while now that gay couples will look at adoption as a way to, you know, build a family and to parent. And, you know, I guess somewhat unfortunately, but unfortunately for some special needs kids, that's kind of the pool that they could draw from. Would you agree with that? That, you know, if people sort of said, well, nobody else is going to pick those kids, so same-sex couples.
Well, and statistically, it appears that they probably have more financial resources than many other couples, too, and are better able to provide for the needs of the child. And in our Angels in Adoption last year was a same-sex couple from Anchorage and that were a very successful adoptive family, and we're very proud of them.
Okay. And there's some struggles there, too, I'm sure, you know, especially with some of the cultural views on that. So you're listening to Radio Book Club on 89.5. Please call us at 745-8900 if you'd like to share your thoughts about adoption. One of the concerns that Joyce brings up is with the change in attitudes about single motherhood, and we talked about this a little bit, with less white babies available for adoption. In 1972, there was 19.2% unmarried white mothers who gave up their children. Now it's about 1%. And among never-married black women, the rate has been zero for decades. So I think that really speaks to kind of, you know, an ethnic attitude about this, as well as just how we've changed generationally about this. In other cultures, families may place their children in orphanages because they cannot afford to feed them. They may believe that when taken to the U.S., it's for a short period of time so that the child may be educated and then come back. In other words, adoption means something very different to those families. So, Tammy, do you want to comment at all about, you know, in working with international adoptions, just how you can, certify or verify that these kids are legally available for adoption?
Since we don't do any of the placing, we're usually contracted through a placing agency to provide the post placements once they're home. So
talk a little bit about that. What does that involve?
Usually, a family will call us once they have an agency that they're going through. They know which country. They'll call us to provide that home study so that they can put together their dossier and send it over before they can get matched with the child or get on a waiting. Once they're matched, say from China, then we're called again either from the family or from the agency that's placing with them to do post-placements for them. And those reports are just, depending on the country, is how many times you do it and for how long. But that's just to make sure to check on the family to make sure that the child's needs are being met and that the family is able to get the resources to make that adoption successful. And that's sort of our job in it all.
And one of the things Joyce brings up is the concerns about failed adoptions.
Mm-hmm.
So when, you know, children are brought over from other countries, and this was in the news for a while, and it was part of what was claimed about, like, Russia shutting their doors,
right,
that, you know, children are brought over, and then the adoption is a failed placement. So what do you think goes into that failed placement? What do you think happens? What are some of the reasons?
Well, certainly expectations that are unrealistic for what for how the adoption is actually going to look. You know, people with that expect that love heals all, and children will, you know, learn to appreciate us for our, you know, noble efforts in going to, you know, get them and bring them into our country and bring them into our home and make them part of our family. And if your mindset is about that, rather than, you know, permanency for the child and all it might entail, then sometimes people are disappointed, hurt, and angry about the adoption. And often they won't reach out for support because they don't want, you know, any kind of agency involvement around problems they might be having. So they sometimes try to deal with it on their own and maybe would benefit from, you know, working with programs and maybe therapy or counseling for the family.
So the service that you provide, the post-adoption placement, do you think that that prevents some of those sort of things from happening? Or?
I would hope that it helps. I mean, that's the point of them, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I think it goes back to the expectations of the family, but also the education prior to placement, to not go into it thinking rainbows and butterflies when you need to be prepared for these kiddos that have not had a parental figure, who haven't had the touch and the love and the boundaries and the and their expectations mm-hmm. of what's appropriate. But I would our post-placements, that's what we provide. We hope that we're able to give them resources in the community if they're struggling, get them connected with therapy, get them connected with speech, with doctors if they have some sort of medical, and to continue to be there to support them so they don't feel like they have to close off or feel like failures. Hopefully we have built a relationship with them that they can reach out.
Yeah, that's excellent. Yeah. So another kind of interesting thing that Aronson talks about is this idea of destiny or fate and, you know, when they find their child. And I don't know, that sounded a little creepy to me. But
Well, and the question then is, does that mean it was that child's destiny or fate to lose their birth family?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, adoption comes with loss. There's no way for me to gain a child without someone losing that child.
And we'll talk about that some more, too, because I didn't feel like all of the essays in Aronson's book really allowed for that, that, you know, that this child, like you're saying, was just sort of, you know, they're waiting for them. And so just a couple of the quotes from different people who wrote, I like to think that destiny didn't bring Yunte to us, but rather us to Yunte because of all the new laughter and smiles he has given us. Just scary faces. My guests are making scary faces.
No, okay. I mean, I think that's true. But I also think, I mean, not necessarily destiny or fate, but when I talk to families, especially for the waiting child and their inquiring, when they call me on that one kid they found in the exchange, and they think this is yeah. the kid for them, and they don't know nothing about the kid, really. They've seen a picture in a blurb that's usually fluffy. You have to read between the lines.
Mm-hmm.
You have to prepare them for might not be it. Don't put all of your eggs in one basket. Like,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I also motivate them if it takes a while, because sometimes it can take a while to get matched with the kid that's really good for your family, and then that child's going to mesh in and you have the right skills to help that child grow.
Mm-hmm.
I do tell them that it's going to happen when it's supposed to happen. Fate, destiny, I don't know, but when it's supposed to happen, it will.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll be, I mean, thankful that you waited, because this is the child that's supposed to be. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
I mean, I feel like that helps families realize that they're not being rejected every single time that they inquire, and then social worker's like, you're not really the best fit. It's not because you're not a good family. It's because...
Okay. That's, you know, and I like the way you're saying that, because then the family is going, well, you know, maybe that would not have been a good fit. And I think that's a good way to think about it, because you certainly didn't marry every person you dated.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah, right?
So the same thing, you know, that as you're trying to make this meshing come together, that it does need to have a lot of consideration for all of the different factors.
Well,
right. People.
The matching process. I mean, it would be unfair to these children to find just one family for one child.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we really need to be able to look at several families in order to make the best decision for that child.
So just a couple other quotes, and you can comment or not. But another one said, Lou was our fate and our destiny. She was our calling from the beginning, which we suspect traces back even further than we can comprehend. And a photo popped up, and I gasped. It was her, that child I had always been waiting for. I mean, that's almost like a love at first sight kind of statement, right? Where
mm-hmm.
it's sort of like, and you made it sound like some parents, you know, they'll do that. It's and I hate to think of this, but, you know, it's almost like a child catalog. You know, they're looking at pictures and little blurbs and going, oh, yeah, that's the one we want.
Yep. They get very, you know, very stuck, and their heart goes into it. It's heartbreaking when families get that response back saying, mm-hmm. you know, we don't necessarily feel like this is the best fit for the child. it's heartbreaking because they put all of their heart into this kid that they've just seen a picture of and read a small blurb and can imagine their lives with this child mm-hmm. because the child either looks like them or,
right.
you know, has some it reminds them of somebody
yeah.
versus, you know, really getting information on the kid and trying to figure out, really, are you prepared to parent a child with those special needs?
And when I send people to look at the Adoption Exchange, Northwest Adoption Exchange, and the Alaskan Exchange, I always suggest, you know, kind of read between the lines. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's only a given amount of information available. There's probably a reason that that child hasn't achieved permanency, and many of them have been on the exchange for quite a while.
Mm-hmm. Many of them are older, for Alaska at yeah. least. Many of them are older.
So as you were talking, I flashed on when I was trying to buy a used car, and I saw myself in that red Toyota. And then I went, and it was already sold. So, you know, but bad comparison maybe. But still, you know, that we do that as human beings, that, oh, that, oh that's, you know, or when you're buying a house or anything, that is the thing for me.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, it's not. So what might be some of the things that you would tell adoptive, you know, pre-adoptive parents then that why this isn't a good fit? What might be some of the things you're looking at with regarding fit?
Well, in our regards, I mean, I don't make any I don't make any placing decisions, really. I mean, the social workers do.
Mm-hmm.
And so usually I'll just let the family know this is what, you know, this is what the social worker passed on to me, and we'll talk about it. But when they call me and tell me specifically, I want to go through this program specifically for this kid and this is it, we talk a lot about not putting your eggs all in one basket in a sense. And I try to prepare them for the idea that because it is nationwide, that there might be 30 other families who also think this kid is just for them and it might not work out the way you planned. And mm-hmm. so I try to prepare them ahead of time, but it doesn't always help, I guess.
Do they get just as excited each time then, do you think? Or is it after a while like, well, okay, we'll take number 10?
No, I think that, well, actually, unfortunately, most of the families that come to me with one kid in mind, if they're not selected, they don't go forward. I still talk to them, and they're like, well, we'll be back, but I haven't heard from them.
Or they go to other programs. They might try yeah. you know, foster care for a while.
Yeah. But a lot of other families that I've worked with have been open and just inquiring on many children, and it's not because you're not invested in the children. It's you read a small blurb in their picture, and you'd want more information.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a lot of families that are really good at just trying to get information first, get their assessments, get their neuro stuff, and see if you're a good fit.
Okay.
So
one of the other things that we kind of think about, and Betsy brought this up a little bit when she talked about, rescuing some children. And so we're going to go into that in a minute. But since it is the bottom of the hour, I want to do a station identification. And all of our listeners know that you are on Big Cabbage Radio 89.5. And this is Radio Book Club. We're talking about adoption today for National Adoption Awareness Month. So the idea that the child is lucky for being rescued, I think this could go for international as well as national adoptions. Mm-hmm. People seem to have an overwhelming sentiment of how lucky she was to be adopted or saved. None of that's true, not for a second. That's a quote from the book. So, what do you think? I mean, do you hear those kinds of comments? Are there adoptive parents who think the child should feel lucky or more appreciative?
When a lot of the families first come into this, particularly with foster care leading to adoption, they're putting their best foot forward. I've had people come in the door and say, look, we've even got ponies. We've got this big house and all these great things. And so there's this sense that any kid is going to set foot in our house and want to stay.
Mm-hmm.
And then I try to explain the whole process about, 15 out of 22 months before parental rights can be terminated. And in that whole piece, it might happen in 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
But, this isn't the goal today. And
right.
so those families are often, walk out of there a little bit disappointed in
mm-hmm.
the system.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of message does that send to the kid that, that you should be so happy to be here? And then, like you say, if these are foster kids and so reunification is still being worked on, what are they trying to do? Negotiate? Do you want to go back to that or do you want to stay here, where you're so lucky?
Well, there can be that sense too of they're competing. Often birth families feel that, they have all these great things and mm-hmm. they're bribing my kid. And then the kid feels split between loyalty. Maybe they like the nice house and the ponies, but they also love their birth family.
Right. Yeah. Do you have something else to add to that, Tammy? Or
I agree that it's not true for a second in regards to how lucky they are and you've saved them. I mean, I know I've said this a lot, but to me it goes back to motivation. I would hope that there's a lot of families that go into it for that. I mean, they want to help kids in the foster care system, or they mm-hmm. do want to help those kids in orphanages. And I get that motivation. But to always kind of hold that over a kid, like, I saved you, so mm-hmm. you should be thankful to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a really sad message. Yeah.
That's a really sad message. And one for the kid. I mean, mm-hmm. what about the kid's self-worth? What about all of that, too? And sometimes, and I hear it a lot from our families, which is nice, is the fact that you're not saving that kid. Sometimes that kid brings so much more to you than you ever brought. Then, you know?
Yeah. So. And I think Aronson's, the essays in her book do speak to that. That yeah. there's a lot of parents who talk about that, that, you know, this was a fair exchange, or the child is bringing much more than, you know, than what we're offering.
Yeah.
That the gains. But it just reminded me that I was listening to a comedian the other night, too, and she said that she was the kind of person who liked to tell everybody that she had a rescue dog. Oh. You know, so that people would know what a good person she was. That's my rescue dog. So, you know, maybe it's the same mentality. So I do give Aronson credit for identifying some of the hurdles, and we've talked a little bit about some of these, but we can go into a little more depth. So some of the hurdles and challenges that come with adopting, the weight, and some of those essays they talk about can be torture. Mm-hmm. So when they're in the foster system, you said, you know, 15 to 22 months to termination, and then just, again, the wheels move really slow, and it can be years.
Literally. And 3 years is not at all uncommon in our system. But I do see families adopt. We just don't know mm-hmm. for about the first year or two.
Right. And then what do you see with the international or some of the other categories? Do people wait a long time?
Yeah. I mean, international, you can wait a long time. I think it's getting all that paperwork. And from the very beginning, I mean, it seems like you're waiting because you're motivated from day one, where your paperwork can take you a year, and then you're putting into a waiting pool, and then you're waiting to be told if you got selected for a child, and at that point, then you have to wait to actually go see the child. And so it could be years
mm-hmm.
For international, and for infants, it could be years for some families, and it can be quick for some families, because our birth moms select the families. So some families are in there for all but 2 weeks, and other families are in our waiting pool for 2.5 years, because they're being selected by birth mom, and we have no control over that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, I mean, every family is wonderful in their own right. It's just the birth mother walked in and felt this other family was best fit for her child and their openness and their relationship. For foster care, I think that the wait can be long because, again, like you said, like, foster care isn't for adoption. I mean, the idea is that they're going home.
Mm-hmm.
Your job is to take care of these kids and wait till they go home, yeah. Not necessarily adoption. So I think that the wait can be really hard because families love kids. They fall in love with them.
That's right.
And then the kids go home. And it could be 2 years and the kids go home.
Right.
So that yeah. wait, because you have this idea that they're going to be.
They could be ours.
They could be ours.
Yeah.
And so I think that the wait almost for foster care, and a lot of people might disagree, can almost be harder. Because
yeah.
it's like that unknown, and you love kids. You bond with them.
Mm-hmm. As we hope they do,
right,
which is better for the kids. So,
mm-hmm.
And so we've talked about paperwork with international and in-state. We have paperwork too, mm-hmm. but you know, and this kind of speaks to, I think, to people's ability. And I think, you know, we mentioned before we got on the air, Aronson's essays, of course, are pretty wealthy people. I mean, the people who adopted that she has contact with are people who have a lot of money, mm-hmm. and so. You know, and then so along with that, probably have higher education and have the ability to you know, get through all that paperwork and that process. So what do you see as far as, you know, do you think that people who adopt, I mean, is that across socioeconomic lines, or is this really more of a wealthy person kind of?
Some of my families come to us precisely because they don't think they can afford, you know, private adoption.
So you mean doing foster care then?
So yeah, with the hope of adopting. And then and there is a pretty large church communities, a couple of them locally, that have adoption as their mission. And I know some of those families have been able to adopt internationally, but they've had the support of the church and fundraisers and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And Joyce talks a lot about that too, that with churches that it becomes their mission that they, I mean, they have to raise incredible amounts of money.
Yeah, international can be.
Tens of thousands of dollars.
International can be pricey. I mean, even domestic can, I mean, we don't necessarily, I wouldn't necessarily say our families are extremely wealthy. They do a lot of saving and they do a lot of fundraising. But, I mean, I think a lot of them are educated in a sense to know that, how to fundraise and where to get your money from and where to go for help and what resources to grab.
Mm-hmm. Which speaks well to then their ability to parent, probably, especially a child that might have special needs. So one of the things that Aronson touches on and Joyce really gets into is just all the international changes in law requirements. And, in fact, Joyce even faulted Aronson for objecting to when Ethiopia slowed down. One of the things that Joyce talks about is how as the United States people who are adopting internationally, we sort of focus on one country. So it'll be all about China. It'll be all about Russia. And what happens is because there's just this suddenly there's an open enough relationship there. There's not a lot of rules. And, there's been some successful placements out of there. And so there's just like this almost a land grab, but a child grab then that occurs in that country. And then as the country comes to realize, oh, my gosh, these kids really aren't orphans and the birth families are not knowing what happened to their children. And, you know, families aren't really screened that well, that then they kind of tighten up. And so I don't know if one of you want to talk about that and The Hague and how that has played into international adoptions and the rules.
Well, now it plays a huge part. In July, an act passed that basically international adoption can only happen if you're working with a Hague accredited agency. So you're going to have to meet those criteria. And so they all tightened up since July, and that has passed. So I think international adoption is probably going to be harder and hopefully less of that. No rules and kids being adopted that really weren't legally free, because that's the point of the Hague Convention, is to make sure that international adoptions are legitimate and not trafficked children or other things that happen.
Yeah. And that makes sense on a real rational level, but I think what Joyce and Aronson are kind of speaking to is that when people, and you've been touching on this, I mean, when people want the child, they want a child, and this is such an emotional kind of effort in many ways, and now they're told, the hurdles have become higher.
Yep.
The waiting has become longer.
Well, and sometimes they're in the middle of adopting and the country closes and you have to switch countries. I mean, it's not uncommon, I don't think, for our international families to switch countries a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
Because of, if you're adopting from a war-torn country, like, government is up and down.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's uncommon to switch countries.
And some of what I've read, too, have indicated that in some countries, that for some periods of time, that there will be these opportunities for sort of corruption and payola and different, there's so many different entities involved, and so the hotel where they stay and the transportation and the access to the medical providers and the orphanages, and so it is certainly possible to develop an industry around adoption that actually brings money into the economy.
So it makes it all questionable, and some people might argue, well, but the end result is good because these kids, end up maybe in a better family. But I think we've touched on why that's not the only consideration. So.
Well, and we have some documentaries on adoptions out of South Korea, and one of the things that continued to come up was that even when that country's economy was top notch, they still had this huge number of children being adopted and sent outside of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And that it actually was an income source for the government.
So another hurdle can be, and Aronson talks about these feelings of isolation, frustration, loneliness. I think people who are probably committed to this, it becomes their life. They're wrapped up in doing the paperwork and getting those background checks and their references and doing all of that. And, it would be unfortunate if they become isolated, because when they eventually get the child, they're going to need that support system around them. But I can imagine, too, that family and friends are probably tired of hearing about, we can't adopt from, Russia, so we've switched to China, or, every, update that happens. And I don't know if people talk about that, if you hear them talk about getting, you know, frustrated, certainly frustrated, but maybe isolated.
Well, and sometimes other family members may not feel as positive about an international adoption.
Or support for, adult children may not want their parents to adopt. Grandchildren may be jealous if mm-hmm. grandparents are adopting. So there could be, within the family, reasons not to support that. I can see that. So the one thing that Aronson talks about, though, is that the adoptive, pre-adoptive families have to go to the countries to visit.
Mm-hmm.
So, what do you think about that? What benefit do you think there is for that?
Well, I would say the benefit is you get to see your child's culture. You get to – and I think, well, in Aronson's book, I mean, it was a little bit more rainbow butterflies, but they fell in love with their child's culture, and they're more open to the food and all the holidays and all of that. I think if you go over there and you see where this child is coming from, every country has different expectations. Sometimes you have to go over twice. Sometimes you have to stay there for a long period of time. But, I mean, I think that it's hugely beneficial for the family to see where this child is coming from versus just a child coming to you and you have absolutely no idea where he came from.
And Joyce talked a little bit about some failed Ethiopian adoptions where the kids came over, and at first the family was, feeding them their native food so that they could adjust, and then 2 days later, cut them off. And so these children now that are growing up, and it was a failed adoption, but they talk about that, they just expected us to be Americans, within 2 days. And so I think that that's a good point that, by the parents visiting the country, they can certainly have a chance to incorporate some of the cultural elements then into that child's life.
I think seeing the environment, too, mm-hmm. if it were, an orphanage where there's just crib after crib and very little contact with caregivers and, babies that aren't being held mm-hmm. and comforted, it would be really helpful for the family to know that that's is sort of the environment that the infant was in.
Mm-hmm. An understanding of perhaps the behaviors, perhaps why the child is reacting the way he is. A better understanding of where this child came from. And I love that in the book they talked a lot about meeting the caretakers of these children. And some of them were loved on. And just to know that and to be thankful. And I know in one of the stories, and I can't remember the child or the name, but they have a picture of this child with the caretaker, and it's a part of their adoption story.
Mm-hmm.
And to get pictures of where they came from,
right.
It's part of their adoption story. And many of them want to go back and visit, which I think is amazing. And I feel like if they never went there in the first place, the motivation to go there would be different. I mean, it would be harder to go somewhere you've never been. You don't know what the expectations
mm-hmm.
are.
And I think that's part of maybe that fresh air that's been brought to destigmatizing adoption, because before adoptive parents might think, well, we just don't even want them to think about
right.
that horrible time or what that mm-hmm. was like, and so they just put it out of your head. So to celebrate all of those parts of it, like you're saying, is certainly, I guess, a healthier way for the child to come to terms with their new family
where they came from.
Yeah,
I also think the family's scared. They're doing it from the point of they're scared of where the child came from versus being open and honest about where the child came from, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the part about having those pictures, because mm-hmm. where else would the child ever get them if the adoptive family didn't provide them?
Absolutely, yeah. And so many kids come without a history. That's just so sad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you're listening to Radio Book Club on 89.5. We're talking about adoption. If you want to call in, it's 745-8900. So we've touched on a little bit about, some expectations. And I think, one of the things we're talking about here is just that some of these kids have experienced incredible trauma. And a family that's not prepared might think, well, just, they just need some love. And so, like we've been saying, that you go to the country and you see the conditions, that might help them adjust their expectations, that if they've had a real non-contact kind of babyhood and how that can impact a child, just that kind of education. And so what is done to really help prepare parents, do you think, for that kind of, what this child is really going to look like?
Well, I mean, obviously training. There's a ton of training that goes into it. I mean, even international, I think China requires, I mean, it doesn't sound like much, but requires 12 hours, and the other national countries require 10. So there is some training, but I also think it's the part of the agency that they're working with or the social worker that they're working with to make sure that they're getting this education so that their expectations are reasonable, mm-hmm. so that this adoption isn't a failure.
So one of the things, one of the essays in Aronson, this, I think it was a couple who adopted the Tibetan kid, and he was so angry. It was mm-hmm. a brother and sister, I think.
Yeah, I remember.
And then the boy just turned out to be very aggressive. I mean, this is one of those, you know, extremes maybe that puts fear in other pre-adoptive families' minds that, you know, he became physically violent in the home and ended up needing to be, did they actually eventually hospitalize him? I can't remember if that was avoided.
I think he was. I think he was hospitalized for a short period of time. But I think that goes back to making sure that the families aren't isolating themselves, that they're mm-hmm. reaching out for help, that they know the resources in their community. And I think that goes back to the education. Before you adopt, I mean, it, regardless if it's international, infant, or foster care, that you know the resources in your community. You know where there's therapy or there's speech. All of that's already in place. So when you're in the midst of the crisis is not when you're struggling to find somewhere to go
mm-hmm.
because that's not where your mind is. Like, it's harder.
And I give a lot of credit to those parents who stick it out and not to say, well, okay, we gave it our best shot. Let's give them back. You know, some parents do that with their biological children. But I think that, you know, all those things that you're saying, that kind of the pre-education and knowing what the resources are, so if things start to go badly, that they can tap into that.
Well, and sometimes our families don't know, you know, everything the child's experienced, the extent of the trauma. And so it could be fetal alcohol spectrum disorder from prenatal exposure. It could be, you know, reactive attachment issues. I mean, there are so many different things that may surface over time that we won't necessarily know about children.
And so, you know, when you talked about the infant program, mm-hmm. I mean, in some ways they're getting an unknown then, other than if the birth mother gives some history.
Most of our birth mothers give history. I mean, they come in, we ask them questions. I mean, we're not going to know everything. And I feel like the birth moms in general are pretty honest because they want what's best for their baby. They're not there because that's not what they want. I mean, they're there to try to make the best decision for them and their baby. So we do get some history. I mean,
okay.
We get if they've drank during their pregnancy, if they've used drugs during their pregnancy, if they've had prenatal care. We ask about their family history of, like, diabetes or cancer. So we try to gather some history for them.
Mm-hmm.
But we also encourage open adoption. And so later in life, the adoptive family can contact the birth mom and ask if something comes up. Like, is this something that's in your family history? We try to gather as much information about birth dad. I mean, that part can be unknown sometimes because mm-hmm. birth mom doesn't always either know or disclose who birth dad is.
Mm-hmm.
So that side can be unknown as far as family history.
So since you brought up open adoption, because that can look different.
Yeah.
I mean, there's lots of variations. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So do you just want to say what are some of the things that, you know, people could look for as far as either side, you know, the birth mother who's relinquishing or the family who's looking to adopt? What are some of the things that they could consider as part of an open adoption?
Letters, pictures.
Yeah, with your programs first.
Yeah, I mean, it can be that huge spectrum. Some birth mothers just open adoption to them is just knowing who the family is, mm-hmm. selecting the family. Others want face-to-face visits. They want to be invited to birthday parties and celebrate holidays. And some just want pictures and letters yearly. I mean, I think they talk about that before placement. So we have what's called a vision merging. And so they kind of come together and talk about what does openness mean to you guys? Like, what are you comfortable with? Some families utilize CSS as sort of their, like, intermediary. Like, they send us letters, and then we send them to the birth mom or vice versa. And other families have great relationships where they have Sunday dinners together, and they do birthday parties together, and they celebrate Christmas together. It's a huge spectrum. I think mm-hmm. that's really scary for families that first come in. When you say openness,
yeah,
they imagine birth mom living at your house and coming on your door, when in reality, birth mom is just as scared for openness as you are.
Hmm.
And in the foster care system, it can look considerably different because if there's been family contact and visitation, often the foster parents are involved in that, you know, throughout the foster care piece. And so as they're heading towards, you know, adoption, they may know quite a bit about the birth family. You know, many times they'll be reluctant to commit to more than just, you know, contact will be at our discretion. as part of the agreement, you know, in, around the adoption. But and that can be the, you know, a P.O. box or school pictures or, you know, an agreement for those things. But sometimes it can be a very close relationship. Maybe they were, you know, great support for the birth family and the birth family is comfortable with the child, you know, being a part of their family and wants to still participate on some level and they're okay with it.
And I think it changes over time. Mm-hmm. I mean, it can it can go where you have really good open communication and you see them often to years where maybe you get a letter. I mean, I think it changes over time as the relationship evolves or perhaps, I don't know, choices have been made that don't make them safe for the kids to see them right now. But that doesn't mean that's forever.
Mm-hmm.
I think or at least I feel like our families do a really good job at maintaining that communication or that openness at the safety of the kid.
Okay, so yeah, because that's the other side of it. They still have to be protective.
Right.
And then there's families that ask for a great deal, and then over time that, you know, eventually the mailing address is no longer good, phone number is no longer good, and it just ends. But at least the adoptive family has, you know, built it in and tried to support it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the child won't blame them for making the decision that kept it from happening.
Okay.
We keep our records for 100 years, at least for our infant. And so a lot of birth moms, if they do move or their numbers change, and sometimes it could be 15 years later, they'll call and be like, I want to update my address in case so-and-so calls. And so we're able to save that into their file.
So we touched on this a little bit and, you know, talking about the money, I just want to give you this quote from Joyce. Seeing adoption as a divine mission leads people to embrace an industry in which they routinely spend $20,000 to $40,000 to adopt a child without being willing to spend several hundred dollars to preserve the original family. Taking children from the poor becomes normalized standard practice, justified by the sense that adopters are emulating God. So, you know, we talked a little bit about the money part of it, but so do you just have any other comments? You know, what do you think about the amount of money that's spent for private adoptions?
Well, I would like to think that that there are children that could remain in place with their birth families if some of that money were spent towards, you know, programs to assist that family,
mm-hmm.
You know, where families are, it's open for services, they're getting some help and some case management, rather than the additional trauma of removing the child. And in some cases, a family can do better, but they might need, you know, some extra help. And so, you know, how money is spent makes a big difference.
And Joyce talks about that when Ethiopia went from 50 a day to 5 a day, that really it was starting to invest some of that money back into exactly what you're saying, because if families are coming in because, you know, they can't feed all of their children and placing them in orphanages, and then these children are being adopted to the United States, that's not necessarily the best thing. And you said that very well, Betsy. I appreciate that. So the other thing Joyce is getting at in her book is the impact on the countries where adoptions have occurred in large numbers to the U.S., and so, you know, thinking about the birth mother, and Aronson does do a little bit about that. And one of the nice quotes I thought was one father who was adopting from Ethiopia talks about meeting the boy that he's going to adopt, the birth mother. And he says, I think only of her eyes, the saddest ones I have ever seen. So, you know, kind of bringing this back around to, you know, your comment earlier about that there is loss involved here. And so how do you speak to pre-adoptive families about that, to recognize that this child may be, on one hand, gaining, but at the same time has experienced a pretty significant loss?
And the birth mom, I think that we touch on that a lot in our infant adoption workshops, that our birth moms that come in, it's not for a lack of loving their kid. They're doing this out of love for their child and wanting to make sure that their child's needs are met as they grow. And they feel at this time they're not able to do that. All of our birth mothers love their babies. And I think a lot of, and our adoptive families, I feel like, know that. I mean, at least our infant adoption, because they have that openness, that open adoption where they get to know the birth mother in her circumstances and get to see her engage with her kid.
And so that's such a critical piece, again, for knowing that adoption story then, that child's story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, it looks like you have something there you want to say.
Oh, well, and we have a lot of books, too, that we loan out, and I suspect you probably do, too. And they're written for different levels, and a lot of the ones for the younger kids are, you know, animals that have, you know, had lost their mom and stories like that, that if you are able to use those with kids to sort of help them, you know, tell their story in a way that's developmentally appropriate to their age. And that can be really helpful. I have had even folks that have adopted privately or internationally come in to borrow materials, and they were people I had never worked with before, but they, you know, found us as a resource. And in one case, the lady had adopted a child as an infant, and she said that by the time the little girl was about 3, that she was seemed to be grieving her birth family, and she was, you know, had just developmentally reached a stage where she was really sort of exploring, you know, her story, her adoption story, and she said that she seemed genuinely sad about it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was, you know, very happy that the woman took it on herself to try to find some resources to help with that. And she, you know, borrowed some of our materials. But I think telling that story in a way where kids can you know, deal with it, you know at the developmental level that they're at, and revisiting it and having a healthy dialogue about it is really, really important.
And that, like you said, can come at different stages. And even when you were talking about when there's an open adoption, if for some reason birth parent disappears, then that loss may occur at that point. And so to help that child, you know, process that grief that, you know, the person was in their life in some ways and now they're not.
Yeah. I do think, though, over time, openness has helped a lot with that grieving process, because when you have a closed adoption, you kind of have an ideal of who your mom is and where you're from and all that versus having the real deal. Like, you know who your mom is. You know where she came from. I think openness sort of helps a little bit with kids who are trying to explore where they came from, because they can at least see who they came from and ask the questions, where when it was a closed adoption, you had no one to ask those questions to. Sometimes you didn't even have records to look at to get those answers.
So I think we ended somewhat on a positive note. For anybody out there who wants more information, can you just give your phone numbers real quick, a number that they could call?
Sure. This is Betsy, ACRF, 376-4678.
And this is Tammy at CSS. You can call me at 222-7316.
So I want to thank Betsy and Tammy for joining me today as we talked about adoption for National Adoption Awareness Month. Next month, we will be discussing Christmas Pudding and Pigeon Pie by Nancy Mitford. My guests will be Melissa Benke and Dylan Getty King. I also want to remind listeners that 89.5 is a community radio station that relies on support from listeners like you. So please take the time to visit our website, radiofreepalmer.org, and become a contributing member. This is Judy Getty with Radio Book Club. Happy reading.